So, riding a tiger, the guru came, smile fierce and friendly, eyes aflame. Riding a tiger from coast to coast, with his vajra he scattered the demon host. Guru, great guru, dispel my sin, hurl back the demon hordes within. Transform them to powers that protect the right. Thou, the thousand-armed, thou, the infinite light. So that's a poem by Bhante, and it's actually a poem to Padmasambhava. I know that I am giving a talk on Avalokiteshvara. It's a poem to Padmasambhava. But what you'll notice is a couple of things. One, you'll notice it's got these sort of perfectly formed poem, actually, because it's an evocation and an invocation. So first of all, Bhante's evoking Padmasambhava, bringing him into the imagination with this description, riding the tiger and the vajra. And then he's invoking, so he's praying, Guru, great Guru, dispel my sin. So that's the first thing to notice. It's perfect sadhana, actually, of evocation, then invocation. And then what you might notice is it's a poem to Padmasambhava, but then at the end of the poem, he says, Thou the thousand-armed. Now, the thousand-armed, of course, is Avalokiteshvara. Thou the infinite light, and the infinite light, of course, is Amitabha. So actually what Bhante is doing in that poem, he's evoking and then invoking Padmasambhava, but then above Padmasambhava, the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, above the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, Amitabha. And actually you'll see in this picture, you haven't got Padmasambhava, we have got Bhante, and then we've got Avalokiteshvara and then Amitabha. Why I wanted to read that poem, well, I don't know why, actually. It was one of those things, you know, sometimes when you're writing a talk, and a sort of image just keeps coming back and back into your mind, or a thought keeps coming back and back into your mind. And I just kept thinking about that poem, and why I was thinking about it is because the last time I read that poem aloud, it was on an order weekend in the summer last year, autumn, summer last year. It was part of an evening. We were with a friend. We were reading Bhante's poems and just sharing them with, there was about, 400 or 500 order members, or 300 or 400, a lot anyway. And we were sharing Bhante's poems. And I was very, very struck by that one. And also, I was very, very, it was very, very apt, because on that order weekend, and I know some of the order members were there, like the shrine was completely the poem, because the shrine was a huge, larger than life-size Padmasambhava. And above Padmasambhava was Avalokiteshvara, and above Amitabha. So, you know, so this poem and the shrine, connected with each other. And then what happened was, the very next day, after reading those poems, Bhante made an appearance on the order weekend. He was coming to give his blessing. There was a special ceremony taking place, and he was giving his blessing to that ceremony. And Paramatha, his helper and long-standing friend, wheeled Bhante in on his wheelchair. Bhante was just sitting about here in relation to the shrine, quietly sitting, giving his blessing. And then what we all could see was he said something to Paramatha, he whispered something to him, and obviously what he'd asked for was to circumambulate the shrine. And it was very, very, very strong, because what Bhante did. He was being wheeled round, certain man lit in his foot, he'd been wheeled round the shrine, and it was enough for him to go back. And he was just bowing, bowing, bowing. So he's bowing to the front, but not just the front, bowing to the side, and like just sort of bowing his way around the shrine. And it made, it had a really powerful effect on me, seeing that, and a very powerful effect on my imagination ever since. And even more so since it was the last time I saw, and many of us saw, Bhante still alive. So that was the last time I saw Bhante alive, was seeing him just in this gesture of reverence to this shrine. So I don't know, something about the poem and then seeing Bhante do that, they're very connected in my mind. And the poem, it's almost like you've got, well, the sort of descent, for want of a better word, like Amitabha, who's the Buddha of the Dharmakaya, the kind of last thing before, the last form before formlessness, and then Avalokiteshvara, the Sambhogakaya, the realm of the Bodhisattvas, and then Padmasambhava, the Nirmanakaya. So in the poem you've got that sort of descent, as it were. And then in this image of Bhante, you've got, it's just so exactly right, actually, because you've got Bhante, like looking up, 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 like looking up. Trivi's lives and looking up with reverence, with gratitude. So it was a perfect, I think that's why it stayed so powerfully in my imagination, because it was, well, that's what lineage is. That's the real meaning of lineage. When we think about lineage, it's an interesting word. Sometimes it can feel a bit formal, as if we were thinking about something like a family tree or something like that. But really, in Buddhism, it's not like that at all. And the lineage is a lineage of inspiration. It's a truth. It's a living spiritual reality. And yeah, I think that was what I and all of us saw being enacted, really, with Bhante, just a circumambulating and bowing before this lineage, above his head, above Bhante's head, as it were, Padmasambhava. Above Padmasambhava, the thousand-armed Avalokiteshvara, these thousand arms just suggestive of the, well, just the omnipresence of compassion, and then Amitabha, the infinite light, eternal life. Just this image of there is our own teacher, sort of alive, a living teacher, sort of in time, and then connected to something beyond time in this lineage of inspiration. Then, of course, Bhante died after that. Very soon after that, Bhante died. And I was lucky enough to be at Adishtana just after he died. Bhante, with his impeccable timing, died just before an international college meeting where all the members of the College of Public Preceptors, Arpa Priya was there and others, were there together from India and Australasia and everything. So we were all there, Bhante had died, and we got the privilege of doing many rituals and vigils. And what I remember was, we were all kind of sort of taking this in, that Bhante died, in a very, very heightened, very, very positive atmosphere. And I'm sure, actually, it wasn't just there at Adishtana. I'm sure it was at all Buddhist centres all over, this kind of heightened, very positive atmosphere. And I particularly remember something Sadaloka said, Sadaloka, the chair of the college, said when we just arrived and he was welcoming us. He said he was trying to put it into words what he was experiencing and what, in a way, the collective was experiencing. And he said Bhante just feels more present than ever. And he said it's as if his physical body was a distraction to who he really is. And now that's gone, as it were. we can experience Bhante who he really is. And that felt just so true, and also a great mystery, and a great truth to be pondered on, actually, because it really, it challenges our emotions, our challenges our perceptions, rather, of what, what a person is and what personal connection is. Because all of us, and I'm sure many of you felt this too, felt more connected than ever to Bhante, felt exactly right what Sadaloka said, as if his physical presence in time and space was a distraction from who he really is. That felt like really, really true. And what I've been thinking of since, and very, very prompted by Subhuti's, both his eulogy at Bhante's funeral, which many of you will have heard. If you haven't listened to it, it was recorded and it is really worth listening to. Well, all the eulogies actually were absolutely amazing. Actually, I don't want to single one eulogy out over another. I'm only mentioning Subhuti's because it was then followed up by Subhuti and some more talks at the London Buddhist Centre. And he was pondering this mystery as well of who are we really? Who are any of us really? And he was saying that all of us have these two aspects. We've got our human personality and we've got something beyond personality. And all of us have got those aspects. And personality actually is empty. Really, in reality, but we've all got this personality in time and space. And I guess what we're trying to do with our human personality is to try and become more and more transparent to that aspect that is beyond time and space. That's present all the time, that's present and available to us all the time, but what we're doing is we're shielding ourselves from it. As I've said before, maybe even here before, that we're, most of our time, we are sort of walking, talking defence mechanism against reality. Reality is trying to present itself to us all the time, but we are defending ourselves against it all the time, or nearly all the time. Every now and then we allow a little glimmer through and then we go, no, that's enough, and we defend ourselves against it. That's what avidya is. That's what ignorance is. And what we're trying to do is become more and more transparent to something that's beyond personality. I would say that must be what a Buddha is a being who's become completely transparent to that something that's beyond personality, that's outside time and space. And we could say, as aspiring Buddhas, that's what we're living our Dharma life for. Those who we look up to that are more practiced than us, and I'm thinking especially Bhante, are those who have become more transparent to that. And also you could say that, well, now Bhante's died in a way, what we feel is that spiritual energy, that's what we're left with. So what Bhante was doing when he was circumambulating that shrine and the last weeks of his life in front of all of us. I mean, such a teaching, really, in a way. He probably wasn't self-consciously meaning it as a teaching. He was just doing it. Well, he wouldn't, but he was just doing it to do it. But it's such a teaching. What he was doing is, guru yoga. So there's a form of practice called guru yoga, which one can practice where you're imagining this lineage above your head and descending through the crown of your head into your heart. That was what Bhante was doing. And in a sense, that's what we were doing, like watching Bhante doing it, as it were. When you're actually, as a practice that one might take up, it's one of the order practices, guru yoga, kalyana, mitra yoga. And in the sort of ancient Tibetan versions, you'd be, as you're doing this practice, you'd be imagining yourself as Dakini doing that practice. So you'd be sort of dissolving your own being into the being of a Dakini and imagining the lineage of teachers above your head. And Bhante said, what you're aiming for is a sense of Dakini communicating with Dakini, which I really love that. I really love that. So, yeah, so what we're... how we might describe what we're doing, sort of, you know, stimulated by this kind of picture that I'm giving you, is that in our Dharma lives, we're trying to connect with that current of spiritual energy from this lineage above us, yeah? And we're trying to connect with the... At its best, that's a communication of Dakini, the sort of Dakini potential within us, with Dakini. It's like it's like a flame. I think the flames brought a flame as the best image for it, really. I think there's something, again, I might have said this before even here, but there's something so kind of, it's so ordinary, the lighting of one flame to another, but I always think it's such a potent symbol. You know, when you just come towards the shrine and, as we might do later, light a candle. It's kind of an amazing thing, really, isn't it? Because you light your candle, but the original candle's still alight, and something new's been sparked off. So I think connecting with this lineage of inspiration, the best image for it is something like a flame, because I think that shows that it's something living that's been sparked off. It's not like a, not that a thing's been handed down, like da da da, from, you know, somebody to somebody else. It's like something, what you're trying to connect with is some sort of current being sparked off. And of course, what we hope is it doesn't end with us, that current, you know, continues with us as well, and that somehow we may be a vehicle, for want of a better word, for that current of spiritual energy to keep being, keep being sparked off in others. Another image for it is a seed. Again, a very, very simple yet potent image that the Kalyana Mitra, it sort of plants a seed, or the guru even plants a seed in the disciple, which eventually becomes a lotus. Again, what's really good about that image is the fluidity that actually in that image that then disciple becomes guru, as it were, very, very different from, I was brought up a Christian, and, you know, one of the primary things about that was you'd never, you know, you can never be God. God was always out there, you can never be God. But this image turns that on its head. So just to maybe sort of sum up what I've said so far, starting with the poem and this image of Bhante circumambulating, is that if we want to grow, for any human growth, not just as Buddhists, I think for any human growth, but maybe particularly as Buddhists, we have to look up, yeah? We have to look up. We have to be aware of these different dimensions and activate them. And we have to, in a sense, commit ourselves to something that goes beyond ourselves. That's what looking up means. I think it's only when we do that, only when we commit ourselves to something that goes way beyond ourselves, then paradoxically we can be fully ourselves. If all we commit ourselves is to ourselves, we'd only become ever a tiny, tiny fraction of what we could become The only way, paradoxically, to be fully ourselves is to commit ourselves to something much, much, much bigger and higher and deeper, whichever metaphor you want to use, than ourselves. And that's why we need a teacher. The teacher is a Kalyana Mitra, a friend, not in the personal sense. And that was the relationship. I've talked about it as Bhante Padmasambhava Avalokiteshvara Amitabha. So that was a relationship of Avalokiteshvara to Amitabha too. So you've got Amitabha above Avalokiteshvara. So it's amazing, isn't it, that this looking up just keeps on going up, up, up. Maybe there's someone even beyond Amitabha that we can't even see, you know, that's beyond or that's too subtle. Well, actually, there must be. There must be even beyond that, but it's just too subtle for us to even imagine or imagine we can imagine. So there's this looking up is part of any human growth and part of Dharma life. And that's a relationship of, yeah, as I say, Avalokiteshvara to Amitabha as well. As we may know, the myth of Avalokiteshvara is that Avalokiteshvara looks at all the suffering in the world, looks down on all the suffering, and makes a vow to redeem all beings. And he's working at that for aeons, or I don't know how long. And then and in the vow he said, but if I ever have even a moment of doubt, may I be shattered into pieces. And so he works for aeons and aeons, saving all beings. And then he looks down over the land of Tibet and sees it's still full of suffering, that hardly any beings have been saved. And he has a moment of despondency and thinks, oh, what's the use? And at that moment, his vow comes true and he's shattered into 1,000 parts. And he cries out for help to his teacher, his guru, his Kalyana Mitra, Amitabha. And Amitabha reassembles him into the figure we know as the 1,000-armed, 11-headed Avalokiteshvara. Those 1,000 arms reaching out to all beings, and those 11 heads able to look in all directions, and each hand has an eye as well. So very, very potent myth in so many ways. I wanted to draw out that aspect of Avalokiteshvara is looking up to Amitabha. That's the relationship of Avalokiteshvara to Amitabha. It's that Amitabha is the guru, the Kalyana Mitra, who comes to the aid of Avalokiteshvara. It's kind of an aside in a way, but I think it's important enough to say. It was just dawning on me when I was thinking about this. It's something about, well, just the importance of taking on enormous tasks, really. Perhaps it's in the same way that we have to look up to something much beyond us. If we want to be kind of worthy of being human, really, if I'm allowed to say that, I think we have to take on enormous tasks. We have to take on things that, in a certain sense, it's ridiculous in a way. We have to take on things that are beyond us, or beyond us as us. Or else we'll never grow. That in order to grow, we have to take on something that's really, really weighty, in a certain sense, too weighty for us. I don't want this to sound wrong. I don't mean it in any way. I was going to say in some ways that would be the death of us, but then I thought maybe that makes us sound like a martyr, which I don't mean. I mean it would be the death of the old us, you know. That's what I mean. We've got to take something big enough that actually we can't do. And in the most positive way, it sort of breaks us apart, because then we'll come together as something new. Yeah, if we call out to our Kalyana Mitras. Actually, probably that's why we need Kalyana Mitras, for when it's too big for us, then we call out to them, and then they help us to sort of reassemble ourselves as that new, bigger person. they help us through the humiliation of we haven't been able to do it. We sort of need that humiliation. I mean in that positively. I don't mean that any person should humiliate another. I just mean that the Dharma life, if we're really living it, it will be a series of humiliations. That's kind of probably how we know we're living it. Anyway, you can ask me about that later. But, you know, we have to learn to live with feeling uncomfortable, even shattered, like Avalokiteshvara. We have to learn that that is part of it. That's not it gone wrong. That's it gone right. And that'll only happen if you take on a sort of weight. Yeah, if you take on something that's weighty enough to be too big, to be outside your comfort zone, not just to do things that we know we can do, but to do things we think, I can't do that. As long as our spiritual friends think we can do it, I think we should do it. That's my kind of become my rule of life. If other people think I can do it, and they're people that I look up to, especially if they think I can do it, I'm going to say, yeah, okay, I'll do it. Even if inside I'm going, what? Me do that? I can't, you know. If they believe in me, I'll give it a go, and usually be humiliated along the way, but then that's why you've got those spiritual friends, yeah? So if you want to grow, you have to look up. That's what I'm hoping to illustrate by this. I'm talking about this lineage, kind of us looking up and, as it were, the blessings coming down. And that's certainly what Bhante was doing. Beautiful, beautiful last living message to us was circumambulating, as it were, looking up, up, up. So if you want to grow, you have to look up. But if you want to grow as well, you have to also reach out. You have to look up, you have to reach out. And this reaching out is shown by the figure we have on the shrine. I hope everybody can see it. So this is the figure of four-armed Avalokiteshvara. So Avalokiteshvara appears in different forms. I've been talking a little about the thousand-armed form, but now I'm going to talk about the four-armed form. So you may be able to see, but in case you can't, I'll describe the figure. So the figure has four arms, and the middle two hands are joined like this. Well, they're not exactly joined, they're holding a jewel, the Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling jewel that fulfills all wishes. And then the two arms out to the side, one is holding a lotus, and one, I think it's this way around, one's holding a lotus and one is holding a mala, a rosary. And these four arms, you could say, are the four arms of spiritual friendship, of aspects of spiritual friendship. So there's four traditional, in Tantric Buddhism, there's four traditional aspects of spiritual friendship. So there's four ways of reaching out. It's not four separate ways. The idea is, the idea is that all of us become this four-armed Avalokiteshvara and reach out in these four ways. These four ways come from Tantric Buddhism, and they're called the four Tantric rites of friendship. You may have heard of them. I'll tell you about them because they're a fabulous way to think about friendship, actually. And they're very, very practical as well as very visionary. So having given us this vision of looking up, I'm now going to give you this practical way of reaching out, which is also essential for our own growth. So one of these outstretched hands holds a lotus. The lotus represents the rite of fascination. So this is very, very, well, it's the very kind of, this is the basis of friendship. It's the basis of any friendship, never mind a spiritual friendship, because it means taking an interest in other people. That's the beginning of it, just simply taking an interest, feeling for other people. And in a series of talks given by Subhuti, He talks about it really beautifully and quite aptly for this time of year. He says it's the equivalent of springtime, but in other beings. So just as, you know, when you see, and we're starting to see, aren't we, the first snowdrops coming up and even daffodils. Like, I can't even imagine anybody who couldn't be moved by that growth. It's just uplifting. It's kind of like, look, spring's coming. So it's just, you can't help but, you know, I don't know, just have a feelingful relationship to that. So Subhuti talks about taking an interest in other people's, just like that, especially when you're taking an interest in their growth and the growth of other people. It's that same, like, when you see people, like, flourishing, that is, like, the equivalent of springtime. This aspect of fascination is it's taking an interest in other people and perhaps even more sort of challenging in a way, especially for us as Dharma practitioners and Sangha members, is recognising that other people will feel that for us, especially here we're at the Buddhist Centre. We'll probably be meeting people who are coming along more newly to the Buddhist Centre. People will, they'll feel that for us. They'll see something of the Dharma, you know, to the extent we've been practicing the Dharma, however long or short we've been practicing it, people will, they'll sort of intuit that in us. And we have to, it's a practice actually, to allow people to feel that for us, not to sort of squash it in other people. That can be quite hard because we are not yet Buddhas. If we're not yet Buddhas, maybe I shouldn't presume on you, but I'm certainly not yet a Buddha. So any of us who are not yet Buddhas, we have to. So at the same time, we have to be coming to terms with ourselves as conditioned beings. At the same time, trying to let ourselves be a channel for what goes beyond conditioning. Of course, we're not doing that self-consciously, but we have to do both of them at the same time. That's what I mean about not sort of crushing it out of, I don't know, out of a sort of false something or other. It's so easy to crush that. It's a bit uncomfortable actually when people look to us like that, but somehow we've got to allow that. So that's the hand that holds the lotus, that lotus of growth. That's a rite of fascination. The hand that holds the mala, the rosary, that is the rite of maturation. It's kind of the blessing rite, really. It's the rite that gives blessings, that responds to other people's potential. It's such an important aspect of friendship that responds to other people's potential and encourages that in them. I remember this really, really strongly myself when I first came along to the Buddhist Centre, the London Buddhist Centre. And at the time, I was quite young at the time. I was in my early 20s and I was working on my first job. In fact, my only sort of job, as it were, that wasn't in the Buddhist Centre. And I was working in this as an editor. It was quite a fancy job, actually, although I didn't realise it was at the time. I thought all London jobs were like this. Anyway, I was in this job working as an editor. And then we used to have this cafe at the time attached to London Buddhist Centre called the Cherry Orchard. Some of you may remember it. And what I used to do is I just used to go and help there on Saturdays. I felt so grateful for what I was learning and the friendships I was given at the London Buddhist Centre. I used to just go and help out in the cafe at weekends, every other Saturday, I think. And I remember very clearly after one of those shifts, I remember the thought in my mind really, really clearly, leaving one day, was I suddenly thought, these women, it was a women's team there, I thought, these women believe in me more than I believe in myself. It was a very, very clear thought in my mind. It was a very positive thought. And that was the moment I decided to leave this Royal Society job where I was an editor and come and work in the cafe. And I thought, oh yeah, that's what they did. They responded to my potential. Actually, Sada and I, we worked together there, I just realised. That's the rite of maturation. Do you see, they lifted me up by their belief in me, actually. Kind of lovely that it's a rosary, a mala is a symbol for that, because I think more and more I think that is the rite of blessing. We bless people when we believe. And it's a lovely, lovely thing when somebody believes in you, isn't it? And we can do that for other people. Such a gift. It's like the gift of confidence, isn't it? Believing in their potential. So that's these two hands. And the hands joined around the Chintamani, the wish-fulfilling jewel, they are the rite of pacification and the rite of destruction. So you might think that's interesting. What's destruction got to do with friendship? So when we're employing this tantric rite of destruction, it's not employed in violence. It's not a destruction that harms or hurts. What's been destroyed is limiting views so that something creative can come through. And sometimes that might be employed in a fierce way, a positively fierce way. I do have one friend who has been quite fierce with me in the past, but very, very skillfully fierce, and has really... it's brought out the best in me. It's brought out the best in me. But more and more I've been thinking that I think this rite of destruction, when it's at its most skillful, the other person doesn't even know about it, in a way. They don't even know you've done it, as it were. I think that's when it's at its most skillful, that you've... you've helped somebody destroy a limiting view in such a way that, well, probably it must be in such a way that they've seen something for themselves. Yeah, they don't sort of feel that anything's being done to them, as it were. You've helped them. You've just asked the right question at the right time, and something's dawned on them, and an old limiting view. Yeah, you've helped to destroy that, but they haven't even felt it, they haven't even noticed it. All they know is they suddenly feel more free and more happy. So I think I think the rite of destruction is best when it's kind of invisible, but no less potent for that. And then the rite of pacification. So that is it's to do with integration, really, because what's been pacified is all the turbulent forces. Of course, the first person we've got to pacify them in is ourselves, really. To the extent we pacify those turbulent forces in ourselves, we'll be an agent for the rite of pacification. Again, if we really have pacified those forces in ourselves, when we come in contact with other people, they'll just know that. Actually, we probably all know people like that, that we know they've really integrated themselves in their heights and in their depths, and even just being in their presence, I don't want to even say calming, because that can sound a bit like quietism. The thing that we thought was troubling us seems to be really just irrelevant. You know, they're sort of so much bigger than us. Their very presence stabilises us. That's more what it's like, yeah? Really good to have people like that in our lives, that their very presence stable. As a matter of fact, Shane Ratnagosha's not here, because I was thinking, he's like that to me. You know, his very presence is, you just kind of feel, what was I so bothered about before? You know, I'm just kind of, you know, as a matter of fact, I think he's an excellent exemplar of all these rights, actually. And I think what's really important to remember when we're employing this right of pacification with ourselves or other people is, it's not that we're sort of repressing energy or sort of that, and it's more that you're sort of containing and directing energy. Of course, you probably all know Abante's aphorism, "Peace is a fire." So I think that's what this is very much about. The peace isn't the absence of energy. It's all the energies coming together and moving in the same direction, which is a tremendously potent force. So peace is a fire. So somebody who's adept at this rite of pacification brings perspective, draws everything together. And that's something that we can be for other people. I think it's connected with fidelity as well, that just by being a sort of steady beat, you know, in someone's life when they're going through all their ups and downs, then we're sort of performing, as it were. It's funny, I say performing, but none of these are things you do sort of self-consciously in a way, although at the same time it's quite good to be aware of them and see, well, which ones am I stronger in, which ones can I develop more. So if we want to grow, what I'm saying is we reach up and we reach out. And Avalokiteshvara is in the lineage of looking up, and also in this forearm form is showing us how to reach out, yeah? How to be a spiritual friend. It's a real symbol for this. And actually, you know, what I was saying is we're trying to practice all these rites. We're trying to be adept at practitioners of all. I think it's really beautifully shown in the figure because all these dimensions are it's very symmetrical, it's very harmonious the way you've got these two hands here and then these two just held like this. They're symmetrical and they're all active. All these dimensions are active. I'm going to finish in a moment, and there will be time for a few questions. But I just want to finish on this theme of spiritual friendship as exemplified by Avalokiteshvara. And just I just want to give you three reasons why practicing spiritual friendship is a good thing. I've taken these from Subhuti, really. One is good because it helps people to flourish, and probably we've all been the recipients of spiritual friendship, and that's helped us to flourish. I think it animates our whole movement, spiritual friendship. Without spiritual friendship, what we did would just be hollow. Everything we did would have a hollowness to it. All our institutions and so on would just degenerate into just being just societies bound by rules and so on. It animates them. In fact, spiritual friendship, Kalyana Mitrata, it comes first. Everything else we do, having Buddhist centres and so on, they're a framework to facilitate Kalyana Mitrata. It's not the other way around. All that we do is to facilitate Kalyana Mitrata. That's the animating force. That's how we'll ever have this lineage of inspiration. And the third reason, which I probably already covered, but I'll just go over it again, is the spiritual friendship Kalyana Mitra is a practice for us. If we want to grow, it's something we have to engage in, because it draws more of us out. And what Subhuti said, I love this actually, he said the Kalyana Mitra is definitely a novice bodhisattva, and being a bodhisattva starts with trying to be a decent Kalyana Mitra, a decent spiritual friend. And I love that, because you've got this huge vision, of looking up to Avalokiteshvara, Amitabha, and beyond that. But it starts with the very next generous, friendly thing that we do. Yeah, that's us on that path, on that bodhisattva path. So I hope that's brought the figure of Avalokiteshvara and some of the other figures a little bit more into focus for you. And I think I have got time if anybody wanted to ask any questions. Is that all right? Yeah? So maybe I'll stop talking now and see if there's anything you wanted to ask me about anything I've said. There's probably too many of us to have a sort of discussion, as it were, but so probably you have to just ask me, and I might or might not be able to have an answer. Does anyone have any questions on anything I've said? We've got about maybe 8 minutes or so before tea.
Do the Tibetans look upon Avalokiteshvara as a female? He looked upon as a female as well as a male.
Well, you could say that's an interesting question about male and female. In the end, all bodhisattva and Buddha figures are neither male or female. Yeah, because there's something that's completely got beyond that. Although some of the forms do appear in masculine or feminine form. So Avalokiteshvara appears in masculine form, but also in, can also appear as Kuan Yin, who's a feminine form. But they're not male or female, and they're not sort of gendered in the sense we think of that. It's more of a sort of archetypal masculinity or femininity.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Lovely talk. Thank you very much. You mentioned humiliation.
Mm-hmm.
Positive humiliation.
Yeah.
Could you say a bit more?
Yeah, let me think. Yes. So what do I mean by that? I'm trying to think of how to say more without just repeating myself. Let's think. Ask me more specific. Say a little bit more about what. Leave me out a little bit more.
I suppose when I think about myself, I've learned more from my mistakes than my successes.
Yeah, well, I think that's what I mean. Yeah. I think that's what I mean. That somehow, well, yes, and also if we never take any risks, the only we will stay safe and we'll never make mistakes, but we won't grow. Whereas if we do take risks, we're bound to mess it up. But if we don't, if we respond to that properly, then it can be growthful. Yeah. So we have to respond to it by, again, this is a quote from Ratnagosha. He says, we have to forgive ourselves for not living up to our ideals while at the same time not losing sight of our ideals. So I think, it's taking enough risks to make mistakes and then actively learn from mistakes. And I think our friends will help us both. They'll help us to see whether the risks are an appropriate risk. Some risks are inappropriate because it'd be too risky or too... Sometimes we're just the wrong person for something. That's one thing. But if our friends think we're the right person for something, then I think we can trust them in that. And then also when we make the mistakes and we feel the humiliation, they can also help us to make that a learning experience. Yeah.
Can I still do a supplement?
Yeah.
Because I remember Bhante saying somewhere that you shouldn't take somebody's humiliation away from them.
Ah, yeah.
You got a thought?
Any thoughts on that? Well, I'm sure it sounds like you have. Yeah. Well, I suppose it must be that, mustn't it? The humiliation itself is that's where the learning can come. If we do take it away from someone, we've taken away that opportunity. It's a bit like people probably know the word hri, the sort of regret. We shouldn't take somebody's hri away from them because it's a painful but positive feeling. It must be the same thing that we have to feel it's painful, there's a sting in it, but that's what will propel us into more skillful action in the future. Must be the same with humiliation. Humiliation in that sense is a painful yet positive, or certainly potentially positive mental state. Potentially positive. I suppose not all the different kinds of humiliation, but that where we've taken a risk and it, you know, it's just we've taken a big enough risk to make mistakes. It's important to take a big enough risk to make mistakes, and it's important to allow each other to do that. Otherwise, we'll just try and keep all safe. And anyway, that's completely impossible because life isn't safe. We'll keep ourselves... that's such an important theme, isn't it? Life itself isn't safe. It's so important to say this in this day and age when we're so concerned with safety. I love when Shanta Deva says in the Bodhicharyavatara, he says, life breaks its promise. Like, life will humiliate us, you know. Life will break its promise to us. We've got to be big enough for that. And otherwise, we'll just keep ourselves weak. If we never do anything where we might possibly make a mistake or be humiliated or shattered, we'll never grow, and we'll never grow strong. Yeah, yeah.
If you see someone deeply humiliated, though, and in pain and really giving themselves a hard time, then you can't help but be a bit compassionate, can you?
Yes, but it's interesting. I think what we're saying, I think that's true. That's exactly true. But then it's, what does compassion mean? Because if compassion, it sounds like compassion doesn't mean... it doesn't mean taking that away from them, but it means helping them, that's where these tantric rites come in, helping them to have the strength and confidence to face that. I think compassion means talking to the strength in someone rather than colluding with the weakness in them, which ties in with it. So even if somebody's really failed miserably at something and they're feeling awful, the answer isn't to sort of comfort them in a sort of patronising way. They'll feel that's patronising, but to kind of go, okay, I know you can bear this and I'm going to help you to bear it, you know, and help you to grow from it. In very interesting area, isn't it? Time for one more maybe before tea. Any other areas?
I was just wondering about the mantra that we chant in the puja.
Oh, yeah.
Is that associated with a particular form?
Oh, that's interesting.
Or is it the same mantra for...
Om Mani Padme Hum. Do you know, I don't know, actually. I wonder if it's just think. I feel like if I was to say, I'd be guessing. I think... No, I'd only be guessing, yeah. Yeah. You have to... That can be your homework. That can be your homework, Gina Betty. You can come back next week and tell the class. Yeah.
I'll go beyond myself and take that on.
Well, thank you very much, Ms. Bhadramati, yet again, a very inspiring talk, managing to marry or explain what can appear to be quite
esoteric and slightly alien images, synthesize that into kind of very practical and very manageable inspirations for our practice, looking up, looking out, the importance of Kalyana Mitrata, friendships, the importance of growth through humiliation. So many simple, straightforward, practical things coming from a dissection of what can feel very, very alien. So thank you very much for that. Thank you.